Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are chemical coatings that resist heat, stains, and water. These properties have led to their widespread use in common products, but also to their becoming pervasive in our water supply. Commonly known as forever chemicals because they do not normally degrade in the environment, exposure to PFAS is linked to a wide range of potential health problems. The big question is what can be done to remove PFAS from the nation's water supply. Here today to discuss this important topic is Mohammed Atai Ibrahim, who is environmental engineer and group leader with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He focuses on PFAS treatment at the EPA Center for Environmental Solutions and Emergency Response. Mohammed, I'm really happy to be talking to you today.
Thank you. Yeah, morning to you. Likewise. I'm very happy and thanks for the invitation.
So where will I find PFAS in my everyday environment? Can I see it? Is it identifiable?
It's everywhere. So the closest thing to you, if you wake up in the morning and try to crack an egg and put it in a nonstick surface pan, it is there. As you just explained, their industrial benefits are huge because, as you mentioned, they resist heat, they resist they hate water and oil. So it repel both, and that's why you would find them in any surface that, like nonstick or the raincoats, the carpets the spray that you put on the carpets to make it resist any stain. So this is the closest, but very close to you in your cell phone, it's full of PFAS containing components because again, they have multiple functions in these as well. Researchers found them in like toilet paper. It's very pervasive in terms of like how they found so many directions and ways to penetrate our everyday life.
So if they don't dissolve readily in water, how do they get into the water supply?
Okay, so they resist water because of the very unique chemical structure that you would have there. So a PFAS molecule would have what we call a hydrophobic tail, and that actually what resists or hates water. And then you have an ionized head, and that's what makes it dissolve. So that very unique combination of these two factors makes it very challenging. If you couple that with their concentrations, that they exist at very low concentration compared to the background constituents of other organics or inorganic stuff that you have in water, that makes the challenge even much harder.
So how long have they been around?
Okay, so PFAS was discovered accidentally in one of the company's labs, let's say 8 decades ago. And since then, they have been used in, firefighting foams. That's one of the major application and source of contamination that actually contributed to the spread of PFAS. Compared to like the general chemistry history, the fluorine chemistry is just like 7-8 decades old.
What do we know about the risks to people and living beings?
That's a very good question. The risk needs to be, any information about it need to be coupled with a reminder that it is very essential here. So when we talk about PFAS, it's not a chemical. It's a family of chemical that we are talking about like 5,000 to 8,000, and actually numbers are increasing depending on different definitions of PFAS. So thousands of chemicals with different unique properties, that makes the risk is very also wide in terms of like how to define it. So each of these chemicals would have different risk factors and risk associated with it for human health and environment. But research so far on certain classes and compounds of PFAS showed that they are attributed to different diseases like cancer and reproductive diseases and et cetera. So the risk is there, but as I said, it needs to be always combined with a more information about risk of which PFAS compound exactly.
It strikes me, though, that they've been around for eight decades and we're just learning about the nature of the risks, that the possibilities going forward could be really significant.
I agree. The more, I wouldn't call it even interesting, the sad fact about that some of the risk or health issues were actually came to the attention of some of the manufacturers, let's say, since the 80s. So we are talking about decades of exposure with some concern, but luckily over the past years, the attention about the concern related to PFAS health and environmental hazards is just like being translated in more aggressive actions about like treatment and elimination of these compounds altogether.
Are there prospects for cutting off the supply, that is, to stop the flow of these into the water supply and into the environment?
Okay, so this will take us to your actually very first question about where are they. So since they are everywhere, saying that we will cut it altogether, it's unrealistic. In the U.S., there are some actions against PFAS in certain industries. So earlier this year, the Department of Defense actually issued or released military specification for what is called fluorine-free foams. So as I said, the firefighting foams for military applications was one of the major applications for these PFAS compounds. But we are talking about this October, the Department of Defense is required to propose fluorine-free foam alternatives formulations. So this is one application. Some states are taking proactive moves. So state of California, they are putting some regulation actions against PFAS in certain industries, like in textile or carpets and rugs, with some proposed actions against PFAS and other consumer products. So this is one angle. But if we say, can we cut it altogether? I guess the clear example that shows how it is challenging is it's a living example currently in Europe, because Europe also this year decided that, okay, we will ban PFAS altogether as not just certain chemicals. But there is an exception where their use is deemed irreplaceable. So we are talking about some military applications, some space applications, some what we would call essential use. So you would find a lot of discussion moving forward about that. So to answer your question in a very short format, can we actually ban it altogether? I find that very challenging, unless someone just proposes a magical solution on how to do it.
So in the absence of a magic solution, can we get PFAS out of the potable water supply?
It is now, so the EPA proposed the first ever nationwide PFAS regulation on certain PFAS molecules. So this is not finalized yet. The numbers about the regulations are not final, but expected to be released early 2024. But this is a very big major move to have. Now, to your question about can we remove it, the answer is yes. But in what context and how much is the cost. And this is one of the things in the Office of Research and Development, and as part of the Pipaster and Infrastructure Law, we are now in a big project trying to support needing communities in answering that exact question, because you would find PFAS at different concentrations. And what does this mean from the treatability point of view, that you would require different technologies to tackle that contamination? So what is the optimum treatment train to remove PFAS? This is a question to be answered in, hopefully, in the near future. So now we are moving by joining forces with different communities across the nation, since you would have different water sources, from surface water to groundwater sources. And as I said, you would have PFAS at different concentration, and you would have background constituents, organic and inorganic, at different concentration. And each scenario would require different treatment train. And defining this is one of our targets moving forward.
So do you envision, if and as we move toward a treatment that removes PFAS, do you envision that this would be at the, let's say, at the water treatment plant or at the wellhead, as opposed to in my kitchen?
So the target is actually the first. We would like to get solutions so that the water coming out from the treatment plant is meeting this proposed regulation. And that's why I mentioned that it's a very major step, because now the water quality coming out from a treatment plant would need to meet these certain numbers in terms of the permissible concentrations coming out. But there would be situations where small communities, or if a location that it is dependent on a groundwater, where we call it like pump and treat scenarios, this would be also a direction to go. But the optimum target is to find a solution or solutions that can be proposed at a drinking water treatment plant scale.
Okay, so not a home remedy, if you will. So so you've told me something I didn't know, that they're dissolved in the water supply. So the treatment process, if I understand it, needs to be chemical as opposed to physical. That is, you're not filtering out particles. Is that right?
No, actually, we call it a physico-chemical treatment. So the granular activated carbon, like the charcoal that you would use maybe in a point-of-use system under the sink in your home, or in the treatment plant. So this is another like way of physically separating them. So you remember when I said like the hydrophobic tail of
yes.
the molecule? Mm-hmm. So this is actually what goes and stick to a hydrophobic surface, which is carbon in that example. But then you would be challenged with the PFAS themselves. You would have some of them with longer chain. This means like they are more hydrophobic. They hate water more, and this would make it easier to remove. But then you would have some of these molecules with shorter chain, and they make it hydrophilic, more like loving to water, and the separation with a carbon filter would be challenging. And that's why maybe another solution can be an ion exchange resin. This is one. One of the most effective is actually physical separation by reverse osmosis or nanofiltration. So that actually separates PFAS quite effectively. But then you would think about the cost and how to manage the concentrated waste stream coming out from this treatment technology.
So you'd have to do something with what you remove in a safe way.
Exactly. I always say it like we are trying to avoid making like a mass balance of contamination in nature. It's just like if we are trying to separate it, then we also need to find a way to degrade it, or another description we call it, mineralize it, like totally degrading them and destroying these molecules to minerals that they are not harmful for the environment.
Could I use the word inert when you mineralize them?
Exactly, and that brings us to a very key another key aspect about PFAS, which is the PFAS destruction. So I told you about how much they are chemically stable and physically stable, but they're also very thermally stable. So that carbon-fluorine bond is the shortest and strongest bond in nature, and that makes the degradation target is kind of hard and energy intensive. So this is part of also the big puzzle that we are trying to complete, what would be the separation technology, what would be the destruction technology to be used for treatment of PFAS.
So if I can paraphrase what you've said, or what I understand of what you said, that we have options, but it's still a matter of research to figure out what options work best and what circumstances.
Yes and no. So we have, yes, there are some options, but are they effective in meeting what we desire in terms of, like, water quality? It's a research question of how much a filter can last before you need to replace it. But then we have research questions regarding destruction technologies, emerging technologies for separation, like novel adsorbents, that they can overcome the shortcomings of existing sorbents that you can find in the market. But then adding another layer of complexity, okay, now over the past like 5-6 years, myself and other researchers, we gained a lot of understanding about how to separate it. But then you would find another challenge of, can we scale this material up? So there are some positive examples out there. I guess one of them actually at Northwestern, of taking these proof of concept scenarios and understanding and try to scale that up to get a solution that can be general. But it is not readily available. But hopefully, with the progress that is being made recently, that can be available to contribute to solving this problem soon.
So what I'm getting from you is there's no plug-and-play solution. If I see an ad that says we can solve this problem, it may not be accurate.
That's actually one of the biggest red flags that comes to mind. A lot of vendors and a lot of very active and enthusiastic entrepreneurs out there reach out to me almost on a weekly basis about that they have the magical solution, that we will deal with that solution. Don't worry about it. There is no energy input needed. There is, but given like our understanding that we accumulated over the years, we acknowledge the complexity of the problem, and we try to be actually more realistic and practical in facing it by just like thinking based on what we have in hand, that there will need to be certain design criteria for based on whatever situation that we have. So we are talking about a case-by-case scenario that can be general to other very closely relevant situations or water quality, but there is no general solution that we can point at currently.
So this is a target for both basic and applied research at this point.
Exactly.
So interesting set of problems that you face, and I'm encouraged to know that you're working on it, given your background and your commitment. I really appreciate your telling us about PFAS today. I'm going to want to put you on the list and check back with you in the future to learn more about your progress and understand what we as a community and as a society can do about this risk. So thanks very much for spending the morning with us. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. And I would be so happy to check in with you later because it's moving at a very fast pace. Again, with the proposed regulation and everything associated with it and trying to find solutions. So I believe checking in some month, I can give you a different answer. Not radically different, but I guess and hopefully more positive updates.
Well, we look forward to that. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, Please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I'm Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.